Welcome to another episode of the Emma G podcast. Luke Hirschison is my guest on this episode of the show, and I don't want to brag, but it turns out he's a fan. So my welcome to him was especially warm, and I was really pleased to be able to spend some time with him to have a good old chat. Now, Luke is a huge name in the industry. He has worked with the best and is the best. He's worked with the likes of Sienna Miller, Emma Watson, Giselle, as well as former podcast guest Sally Hughes and Victoria Beckham. He's regularly featured in Vogue, W, ID magazine, and has worked on huge campaigns, on massive shoots, Fashion Week, you name it. He's done it. In this chat, we actually cover a lot of ground, and while hair is in his blood, Luke knew from a very, very young age that without any doubt what his career was going to be. We chat about that, about being creative, and about having a drive and a passion for what you do. We also talk about balance, how to find calm and how to avoid stress, or better still, which is brilliant actually, the way Luke put it, is how to make stress your friend. And we also both talk about our experiences with anxiety. There's also talk about social media, how we both perhaps naively thought, oh, it was never going to take on about a decade ago when things like Twitter and Facebook started cropping up. But also the healthy ways that you can embrace it, as well as how to set goals and progress in your career. We recorded the show at the Hirschison Salon on Conduit Street in central London, one of my favourite places. And you can hear the whir of hairdryers and the chatter of a busy salon floor, but just barely. I love recording these podcasts, and I hope you're enjoying them too. And my conversation with Luke felt really special, and I was incredibly grateful for his time and generosity. This is also a very good time to mention that I'm recording my Ask Me Anything episode in the next couple of days. So if you're listening to this when it goes live, and you have any questions that you'd like me to answer, then please email them to me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. Also, a little bit of news this week, the podcast was featured on Get the Gloss, one of my favourite e-zines. I was interviewed by Anna Hunter from the website, and the link to that can be found over on emmagundewardner.com. As can all the links to Luke, Daniel Hirschison Salons, and anything else that we mentioned during the show. Thank you so much for tuning in, and here he is, the very brilliant Luke Hirschison. Here I am with Luke Hirschison in one of my favourite places in the city of London, the Daniel Hirschison Salon on Conduit Street, which is a haven for stylish, fashionable, good-looking people. It's pretty slick, right?
I hope so.
I did admire the white hair appliances on the way in, and immediately had the impulse to... I told myself I needed them immediately. Isn't that interesting?
Well, that's a nice thought.
Yeah, but I did that. I did that past Topshop, and I did that, but you know, maybe I'm just materialistic. But they're very nice.
Thank you.
So I said we would start off this podcast with a funny story. And this is a funny story. 6 years ago, Fashion Week.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, probably 6 years ago this month, Fashion Week.
I'm dreading what this story is.
I went to the Mulberry party. Stop me if you begin to think.
It's longer than 6 years ago.
Oh, is it? It must be 7.
I think so.
Mulberry fashion party. It was 7 years ago this month. They were serving some really quite sickly sweet cocktails, which I find incredibly drinkable.
Did I spill champagne? No, I'm quite good at that.
No. So I was drunker than I should have been at a work event, essentially.
Hang on, was this in Holland Park?
No, this is at Claridge's. You remember when they'd done up like a...
A forest.
A forest, and there was a ball
and it was a
thing.
Picnic, not a picnic, like a campsite thing.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I have vague recollections. So, the reason why this is significant...
It was a dinner thing. Is it a dinner thing?
Oh, I don't remember eating.
Okay.
I actually, for the last 7 years, hearing the words Luke Hirschison have made a chill go down my back.
Why?
Because... No, you didn't do anything. So it was around the time that you launched the fabulous clip-in hair.
Oh, right.
And clip-in hair wasn't necessarily a new thing, because wefts, etc. have been around for a while, but those fringes were really quite impressive because they were unbelievably wearable and seamless. And so I bought I did get one. I was given one, but I actually bought two more because I had alopecia, so my hairline here is quite weak. So I, for a while, wore a lot of fake fringes, the whinges.
Okay. Yeah, the whinges.
And I had the rock one, and I had the sort of layered one, and the shaggy one, and whatever. And I was drunk, and I was walking to the ladies, and you were coming out of the cloakroom, and I went up to you and went, "Can you tell it's a whinge?" And just didn't say hello. And didn't say no. You said hello. I didn't. I just started pointing at my hair. And
I don't even remember.
No, well, thank God. Anyway, so, and the other thing about that evening, but you know, when you look back, you think that's not a way to act around someone who's actually really a big deal in this industry.
I'm not a big deal.
You are. You've got like these massive salons, and you're a big deal. But then the funnier thing about that night for me was that I vaguely remember getting home. I then contacted the office the next day and said, "I am back to back with shows," and I basically spent the entire day on the floor of my bathroom. And then I think 2 days later I was looking through my phone and found a picture of me with Juliet Lewis, and I'd completely forgotten that I'd met flipping Juliet Lewis
at that party
because there was a magical mystery.
I think I've got really bad memory.
Maybe you're. There's a self-preserving chemical in your brain that just erased this girl running up to you and going, "I'm wearing a whinge."
Yeah, or maybe I was just more drunk than you were.
I kind of hope it's that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you are a big deal. You must say you have to accept that you're a big deal.
So, on one of your podcasts, I think it was Marissa Pierce said about in America, people give you a compliment and they say you're great, and you're kind of like been brought up culturally to go, yeah, I am, I'm totally great, right? And in England, people give you a compliment and you deflect from it, and you say, no, I'm not.
Oh, it's all smoke and mirrors, darling.
Yeah, well, I'm crap, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I've never, not very good with people saying anything nice, so I don't quite know how to handle it, although I'm trying to get better at taking a compliment.
Okay, well, let me ask you this question, because somebody put it to me this way recently, and it made me really stop and pause, because I was saying how I felt about where I was in my career, etc., etc., and just saying there's so much more that I want to do, and they said, what would your 18-year-old self think of you?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's not relevant for you because you started much earlier than that, didn't you?
Yeah, I've been very lucky that I've always known what I wanted to do, and I got brought up basically in hair salons. And my dad tells stories of him taking me to building sites when I was about 4 or 5 and me asking where the basins were going to be. So a lot of people, I think, go through life and struggle to kind of find their path. And I've always been very like blessed and lucky that I always knew that I wanted to be fully involved in this industry in one shape or form.
Even as a wee little thing?
Yeah. And it was not good at school because you try being like a 13-year-old boy in a posh school that wants to be a hairdresser, it doesn't go down very well.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school in Highgate. And I really didn't like school because I thought it was a waste of time, and I just wanted to get on with life, and I wanted to kind of very much be a part of what my dad was doing. And I used to kind of finish work and get the bus up to the salon, and you know, and spend my weekends in the salon. In fact, if as a kid I had been naughty or like something had gone wrong, the punishment was I couldn't come to work on Saturday, which is quite weird, I think, for like so maybe I was a bit of a strange kid in that sense, that you know, everyone
having a work ethic is
not
strange.
I mean, my work ethic is not strange. I've always been a bit of a workaholic, but well, that's probably strange in itself, but I always, you know, I was lucky, you know, I really knew what I wanted to do. So for me, it was like, school was pointless. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't, I'm sure there were benefits to it, but it was pointless in the sense of, I just wanted to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of lucky in the sense of 12, 13, 14, I was very aware of the industry. I was very aware of who was doing what. I was very aware of like who my idols, icons were in terms of hairdressers, which I suppose most people don't get until they actually start working at like 18, 19, and then suddenly your eyes are opened up, aren't they, to the industry, or maybe that comes a while after that. So I suppose in a weird way, I've got like an older, not soul, but an older, like, I remember further back than I'm 37 now, but I started young. In reality, I kind of started even younger because I was quite involved, like aware of it all. Do you know what I mean?
You could realistically say you've got 25 years experience, even though...
Yeah, even though I was crap for 10 years.
Just you've been plugged in and engaged.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. I'm very like aware of like the industry and the people and who did what, and you know, just like you're just aware of it. So I suppose growing up with it and just being interested in it.
So, was there one salon when you were this 4 year old?
So my dad had another business. He had a partner, and they had a business together for about, I don't know, 20 years or so. And he opened his first salon when he was 21 with a couple of other hairdressers, and I think at one point they had kind of three salons, and yeah, they were really successful. And then when I was 12, it all kind of it all basically went a bit tits up, and you know, it wasn't a fun time, and they separated, and there was a massive period of change, and then he started this on his own when I was 12, and that was his first salon under his name. So it was like a really massive point in his life, in a weird way, a massive point in my life. You know, I think, you know, one day I went to school, it was like my dad was this kind of, you know, really well thought of hairdresser, had this really great salon. They had the Royal Warren. It was all quite, you know, posh. And like, you know, I think I, as much as I got bullied for being like the son of a hairdresser, there was also a slight kind of, you know, my dad was different, and that was quite cool. Do you know
like
what I mean?
Rock star different.
Yeah, well, yeah. I suppose if a hairdresser could be a rock star. But do you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden it all went, like everything went, and it was bleak. It was pretty bleak for a while.
Do you think that fed into the work ethic as well?
Massively. But my dad's always been, my dad, you know, he works as hard, if not harder than me, still today. He will never stop hairdressing. Massively forms part of my work ethic. But it's interesting because
Are you quite, you know what the numbers are, you know what the bottom line is, do you pay attention to that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean what I love about my job is how varied it is, and I think I get bored really easily. So I couldn't be behind a chair 5 days a week, I couldn't be in a studio 5 days a week, 6 days a week, I couldn't be, I don't know, teaching 5 days. Like, I have to have the variety, and I'm so lucky that I get to work with, you know, on really high level fashion stuff with amazing, amazing photographers. I get to help run salons from, whether that be like financial point of view, from a education point of view. I mean, I'm kind of feel as comfortable sitting in a, I don't know, sitting in the studio making pictures as I do behind a chair, as I do, you know, with the accountants. I mean, that's what I love, is the like the massive variation, and sometimes it makes your brain completely frazzled, ache. Yeah. Like, really ache. But sometimes it's but I think that's the thing, it's like the variation of it all. I remember starting and people being like, I remember when I was like 17, 18, and I was this little cocky hairdresser that thought he knew everything, and going around to agents, like trying to get an agent and trying to get representation.
Yeah.
And everyone saying, oh, you can't do salon and session, you can't do both. Like, why not? Like, of course you can. Oh no, at some point you're going to have to make a choice. I was only thinking about this the other day. I was like, they all said you have to do one or the other, you know, because at the time you had, it was all very separate.
So when you say salon and session, do you mean literally salon, you'd be in a chair day in, day out, having clients roll in, roll out, or you would be travelling around doing shoots?
Yeah, exactly. They're all like, you have to make a decision at one to the other. And I had a couple of agents at the beginning that really didn't like the fact they couldn't kind of tell me what to do every day because I had other commitments. Mm. And nearly, I don't know, 18 years on, I still haven't chosen between the two. And I think there's been a lot of other people as well that have actually managed to juggle that thing about doing both. Like, why should we have to do one or the other? Do you know what I mean?
So if you've got a bit of a silly season, you've got like a load of shoots and you've got lots of travel, would you almost be like, when I get back, I just need a day in the salon?
No, I just need a day off.
So you don't use them to balance each other out or counter the other?
No, I think it's slightly more organic. I mean, over the past few years, I've cut down. I try and commit to doing two like salon behind the chair days where I'm actually doing clients. Although in reality, it doesn't really work out like that. It's probably more like one or half. There's this commitment to, I think it's really important that I enjoy cutting hair. I still enjoy it, and I think I probably always enjoy it. And I enjoy it more when I'm not stressed, like when you just feel kind of comfortable.
Mm.
And I think it's really important that the team see me cut hair. And I just think it's important to keep doing that. Like my dad does probably 4 days a week behind the chair. He does more than me.
Mm.
And I just think that's something that is like integrally important to the business and to the, you know, to my mind. And
with, I always get a feel that it's a creative skill that you never stop learning. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I learn from my assistants. I hope they learn from us. But yeah, constantly.
I really like that. I know you listen to the podcast with Eugene Suleiman. I love the way he mentors.
Yeah. I think that we were in this meeting the other day, and someone was talking about, I can't even remember, some kind of long-winded word about how we have to have like a, what else do we do kind of for the greater good, like not necessarily charity, but it was more like a kind of social responsibility. And I sometimes come up with these really weird like analogies and everyone laughs, but I do think there's a point to it. I said, well, I think we're a bit like a teaching hospital. And everyone laughed. And I said, well, what I mean is we've trained so many hairdressers over 20 years. And I think what I love doing is this idea that people come here and they watch and they learn and they, you know, it's just a constant, everyone's learning from everyone. I mean, my dad always goes on about, you know, the original surgeons were hairdressers. Like they were, the barbers were yeah, like, you know, were...
Oh, I love that.
Were surgeons. Like, you need to get your leg chopped off. Like, that's
who can handle
a
blade around here?
And, but there's something very like methodical about cutting hair or doing hair to some degree. I know there is this like creative element to it. Of course there is, but there's this like very like methodical part to it. Mm. And I love the fact that, you know, we can help teach people, you know, in the environments, it's constant watching, learning. I mean, I probably learn 80% of it watching.
Mm.
You know, I grew up in salons, like, so no one taught me really, but you get taught by just watching and then doing. It's like a constant like evolution, I think. You're constantly growing and learning.
It's such an interesting skill, I think. And I was talking to someone the other day who said, you would be surprised with hairdressing, one of the things you have to learn to do first is how to hold your scissors.
Yeah.
It's not like how you're cutting paper. And that takes quite a lot of practice.
Yeah, that probably is the first thing. Yeah.
If someone was listening to this who wanted to get into what you do, and perhaps didn't quite understand how, what would be your path to success for them?
Oh, God. It's funny because I think it's changed so much now to when I started. Mm. I sound really like an old person saying
don't
that.
Age yourself, you're younger than me.
No, but I think the whole... I don't know, I'm going to sound a bit old and moany now, but I think that there's this weird need for people to like be instantly successful now.
Mm, isn't
and,
it just?
And not really without kind of putting in the kind of the hard graft that goes alongside it.
Are we talking about Insta fame?
Yeah, like I think there's a lot of brilliant things about, you know, the web and Instagram and social media, but I also think there's a lot of really, really, really bad things about it as well. And I think that success is perceived really differently now to how it used to be.
Mm.
Like, I look at some of the young kids or like the assistants and how they and what their kind of version of good or success is. And like when I grew up or when I started hairdressing, like the greats to me were like obviously my dad, like is you know a massive huge inspiration and you know brilliant, probably one of the best like haircutters I've ever seen, and the way he approaches things is like really really incredible. But I think you know Christiane, Sam McKnight, Guido, Eugene, you know, they were like Trevor Sorby, you know, they were like, there was like a real excellence to what those people did.
So right. I love that.
You know, like just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant hairdressing. Mm.
Pioneering as well.
Pioneering, but like dedicated. Like, and I think, you know, it's sad to say that I had a conversation with someone the other day and they said, they were showing me like someone's Instagram profile, and they were like, you know, it's great, isn't it? Isn't it great? And, you know, this person's got, I mean, this amount of followers, and look who they're doing. You know, and I was like, what's the hair like? I mean, I'm not trying to sound negative here, but I think it's kind of really interesting that, to me, you know, it's always been about the work, the hair, and yeah, okay, over the past 20 years, it's become more and more, we've had a bigger celebrity fixation. I think that's always been there. It's probably grown, and Instagram and all that's kind of made it worse to some degree.
Mm.
But I think what's a shame is there seems to be I think what I miss is how we tend not to kind of elevate people because of their brilliance anymore. Or maybe there's less brilliance around. But whereas, like, when I look at... I remember looking at, like, Trevor Sorby's, like, wedge picture. Or, like, I don't know, Christiane doing, like, buzz cuts in the 80s. Or, I don't know, Guido's Versace campaign. You know, like, I grew up and I was just obsessed. You know, like, I looked at pictures and you were, like, obsessed with, like, the hair. Like, how do they think of that? How do they do that? It's so brilliant. Like, and now I think... It like you don't need to be that good in a way to become, maybe it's more throwaway now, do you know what I mean? But I think you know, for me, like I've always maintained this like thing of like when we started this business and like we're still trying to build it, it's got to be about the work, it's got about what we do, and it's important to have, you know, celebrities and endorsements and all that, but that should sit underneath it. It shouldn't be the... I think a lot of the time with brands, like, celebrities are the thing that propels it before actually the brand or the person even knows what they're about. Does that make sense? Or
yeah, no, I know. I think there are many industries right now that would say a very similar thing. I think photographers, I feel...
Yeah.
I mean, not the kind of photographers that we work with, but photographers who... There are people who've got beautiful Instagram profiles and they do it with their iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And a photographer who spent a long time training will lose out on a job to somebody like that. For example, this is a very rough example. I'm not talking about something I've known about. But that would be... If I was a photographer, I'd feel very frustrated by that.
Mm.
Because I would feel like my skill had been devalued.
I think it's like, you know, before we started this today, you were saying about it's figuring out how you use it for your like for the right benefit or for your benefit. And I think I was saying this to someone the other day. I feel like we're in this. We're kind of lucky enough, unlucky enough, I don't know, to be living in this period of like insane change.
Yes.
Like when I started, there was no mobile phones. It was, you know, we never used a computer for research. We went to the library.
Shot on film.
There's no digital cameras. Instagram didn't exist, none of that. And then all of a sudden, so you had this massive like technological revolution in a way. And I still feel like we're in the middle of it, although I think I'm not sure how much more technology we can all absorb. I wonder kind of how it will all settle. Do you know what I mean? Like in 5 years' time, like where will we be? Because I think it all needs to almost, we all need to kind of figure out our place. You know, like I look at what you're doing, your podcast, so there's a real place, isn't there, for that where people, you can listen to people's stories. Like that's how we ended up doing this, because I was like, this just, I was obsessed with listening to, you know, Adam's and James's and Eugene's and their stories, like people's stories. So I think it's a way, like, there's a lot of weird things about all the social stuff, but I think in a way, you know, it opens up brilliant things as well. It's about, I think, how we figure out how it's all going to settle down, finding everyone's place in the new world, in a way. I think it's kind of interesting.
Not to talk about my podcast, really, but what you just said just made me think, actually, it's almost like the anti-selfie.
Yeah.
Because selfie is just complete veneer, whereas I sort of set out to do this because I really wanted to get under people's skin. So,
well, yeah. I mean, it's definitely real, isn't it? I mean, but there's just, I don't know, it's a weird moment, but I think things like this seem to be kind of definitely, like, it's about that excellence, isn't it? It's about that, like, greatness, and I think it needs more of that. I need more kind of brilliance.
I feel like I now want to start an excellence academy. it just feels like such a good word to use. Should I use it in my Instagram post later?
Yeah.
Completely, like,
I've
missed
got
the point.
Very serious, very quickly.
No. I think you said something then about how much technology can we actually absorb, which always brings me on to a question that I do like to bring up with a lot of my guests, which is about mindfulness. And you talked about stress. And to get to the point, a lot of people who are creative will say that they had a miserable time at school.
Really?
Yes. Because it's very structured and it's completely at odds with the way that a creative person's brain works. I don't even remember my school years very much because I just hung on and I was like, I just have to have hope that when I'm 18,
things will
be okay.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, I didn't really engage. I honestly lived in a fantasy world of my so-called life, Jordan Catalano, and I honestly wanted to be a backing singer with Guns N' Roses. So, but it's interesting that I think when you do have that busy brain and then you get to actually use it in the way that you do and what your work is, there has to be some sort of payoff in terms of switching off. And there, if there isn't, there will be a point where you will say to me in how many years' time, I've started meditating, because I think everybody reaches that point where their brains are overloaded, and I think a creative brain plus social media can be quite a busy little animal.
Yeah. I'm going to answer it in a couple of parts.
I like it.
I think I've always kind of had like a certain amount of anxiety, like quite an anxious person. And when I'm very stressed, that tends to get, or we're very busy, it tends to get worse.
Okay.
And my anxiety manifests itself in kind of different ways. So, used to be very mental, sometimes it can become very physical, and that's a journey that I've been on for a long time to try and manage it as best I can.
Does it manifest in the shape of panic?
No, not so much panic. So no one else would know that I'm anxious, because it's funny, I remember being on like really important jobs really kind of internally, years ago when I started. I remember being on my first big job was my first like really big break. It is 2001.
It's only,
yeah, it is.
See, wow. That's the only one damn thing I can find out about you.
um
And it was with Matt and Marcus, and I'd never worked with them, and I suddenly got kind of shipped out to Sardinia, and I had to go on a plane, and it was 2 weeks after 9/11, and that was all just like, you know, and just remember, you know, internally being really like
churned up
and like kind of wanted to throw up. And I remember someone saying, I think it was Giselle, she went, oh, you're very calm. And I was like, are you blind? You know,
she's so into herself, she doesn't have any empathy.
It was just like, because I think people think I'm probably quite calm, and that was my point, was that you know, anxiety is like, it's quite crippling. I mean, when I started doing shows and not assisting, because I had like a few years of assisting everyone, which was amazing, but there's no pressure on you in a way, because you go to a show, you assist someone, you get to learn loads, and you have to do it, you have to perform. But it's very, when I started getting my own shows, I mean, for like a week before, I'd be like, I don't read bad stomach cramps, I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'd never be able to put the two things together. Do you know what I mean? And actually, as you get older and you get more experience, I'm much better at kind of going. I used to come home and say to my wife when we first got together, oh, I just feel so exhausted. I don't know what's wrong with me. Maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe I should go to the doctor. And she'd be like, you've just got off 3 flights and you haven't been home for 10 days and you've done blah, 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 X, Y, and Z. I'd be like, are you really surprised you feel like this? And I'd be like, oh yeah, I never really thought about that, because like I'm kind of programmed to, like, you know, you keep get the going. Job, you keep going, yeah. You do the job, you keep going, you keep going. It's only really when you stop that it all kind of comes out. But I think I've got much better kind of recognizing balance. And someone on one of your podcasts said something about it was a hairdresser, I think, that said something about how they felt that they got much more from being away from work as they were when they were working.
And was that Paul and Adam?
No, it wasn't. It was someone else. And I had this, like, I went away. I had a really good, like, break after Christmas. And I went away and I can now, probably the first time, totally understand, because I managed to get to a point where I really did, like, switch off. Totally understand how it's so important to, like, the time of not doing anything is actually as, if not more important at the time as when you're crazy, because when you're crazy you can't, there's a certain, like, I don't know, doing shows or pictures and stuff, there is a certain kind of weird creativity I think that comes out of being in that weird, like, panic moment. But I also think that's unsustainable, so it's so important to be able to step away from things, to be able to have some perspective and actually think about things in a calm, like, measured way. I think I'm just starting to, like, after like 18 years, I'm just starting to slightly understand. Like, you talked about meditation, and I would love to be able to be that person that does meditate. And the best advice I got from someone recently was, don't think about it as meditation, think about going into a room and doing nothing for 10 minutes. And I thought that was amazing. He said, if you go into a room and try and think of nothing, you will fail.
You will think of everything.
You will think of everything. And so he said, just do nothing. Just give yourself 10 minutes every day to just do nothing. And I was like, oh, that's... I mean, actually, I've done that twice. So I'm not like, you know, hopefully I'll get better at it. But I thought that was kind of a nice way of thinking of it.
It's a really nice way of thinking of it. I tried downloading... So
I downloaded Headspace.
Yeah.
I didn't get... I mean,
the
I
last
gave
time
up.
You logged in.
And that was like a year ago, yeah. And I only did the free bit.
So I bought the subscription because I was using it, but then I've been listening to the Mirror Sapir hypnotherapy CDs, and it's like, there's only so much time I can give it. Like, I've got to hustle and make a living. But it's crucially important. I think if you do have a creative mind, and you talked then about, it's really frenetic when you're backstage at shows, when you're on shoots, and the pressure on the creative talent can be really intense, and I think the pressure actually makes a lot of people's minds move really, really quickly, and that's where their flashes of brilliance can come out.
Can do, yeah.
But if you don't then give
balance
your mind
out.
A break,
yeah,
that's
you're screwed.
When, yeah.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think I'm getting better at it, but I've got a long way to go.
Is it something that, having had that break over Christmas, that you're right, I will invest in actually making sure that I give it that time?
I think it's a little bit like So I got married about a year and a half ago, and I think you get a little bit older and you kind of realise there's like it's so like the balance is so important. Like I'm probably as driven, if not more driven now than I was 18 years ago. Like that the drive hasn't changed.
Do the goals change?
Yeah, the goals change.
And how do you set goals?
I think as you start achieving things, they kind of change. Mm. Like when I first started, I didn't like, when I was about 18, I had this thing about salons. Like I thought they were really naff. They were really like, there was this, I don't, you probably remember, there was this like kind of connection between like how salons were perceived. It was like, I don't know, mid, late 90s. You know, there was like, it was like the height of grunge. So kind of salons weren't really the place where anything was happening. Mm. You know, like there was like hairdressers like Guido and James Brown, and they were, you know, it was all like, you know, putting a bit of gel on your hair and like no makeup. Makeup was the first time it really happened. And so like salons just weren't very cool. And to top it off, you had hairdressers doing like from salons doing a lot of like morning TV, and this is kind of like, kind of, I don't know, to me at the time, I was just like, oh, I just hate the connection. I hate the, you know, you used to say like, maybe this is how I remember it, but this is my perception of it at the time, was like, it was just all a bit naff.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and the place to be was like, was doing pictures and doing shows. And I mean, that had always been like a passion of mine that I wanted to, and maybe it was because I wanted to do something slightly different to my dad and make my own mark and da da da, and perhaps, but to me, my goal, going back to your thing about like goal, my goal was like, I wanted to make salons cool. I wanted it to be like a cool, like I wanted like you to say a salon, or and people like have a good relationship in their head about what that meant, because it's like the work that was coming out of salons at the time, I just thought it was really like mumsy and naff.
It wasn't, I know,
I'm just, everyone would hate me for saying that because I'm slagging off a period of time, but I just think everyone was very stale. And so I was like, how can we make salons cool again? And I think that's really massively happened now. Like, not taking all the credit at all, because it's not about that. But that was, for me, a goal, like, very, very early on. But as you start getting to that, you're like, oh, what's the next thing?
Was it about making it younger? Was it about making it...
It was like, I felt that... So I felt there were kind of connections out there that didn't kind of give it a particularly like, what's the word? People didn't aspire to go to the salon. When I grew up, and like in the 80s, and my dad had salons in King's Road and Sloane Street, it was like this hangout. It was like this place to go. You know, like, it was a bit like of a
what
scene.
What decade was that?
It was like, you know, the 80s, like,
oh my god, I mean, that is when the King's Road was,
yeah, it was like punks, yeah, and mods, and you had all these like amazing like cultures of people. But you know, it was like you would go to the salon to get a look. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and that was part of your whole character at that point. And then you got to like, this is what I mean about me kind of knowing, like, you know, I was really young at the time, but I took a lot of it in.
Mm.
And then you got to kind of the 90s, it was like grungy, so I suppose salons were a bit like, what do we do? Do you know what I mean? Like,
just
it
dry
wasn't,
your hair.
Yeah, like, do you know what I mean? It was sort of a bit like, this weird moment. And I think when I started, what did we do? We like, it was all very kind of celebrity, and that kind of annoyed me because it wasn't like, I don't know, in London at the time, it wasn't like there were great, there weren't no kind of like London bear. I mean, you had Kate, but Kate was Kate, and it was like all very kind of up there, wasn't it? It was,
yeah,
like, and so from a salon point of view, it was like, how do we make this? We started doing pictures like for the salon and giving haircuts names, trying to make haircuts, you know, we tried to,
give
we,
them the personality.
Yeah, and then we started, you know, doing shows as salons, like, you know, Fashion Week, and we really, I think at the time, no one else, like, salon wise wasn't doing that.
Mm.
And so I remember at the time, like, saying to L'Oreal, you've got to get, you know, you've got to sponsor shows, you've got to do this. That was way before, I mean, now, like, they're all over it,
yeah,
right? But at the time, you know, it was all, to me, it was like, how do I make it relevant again? Like, it's, because I grew up in a time where, like, salons were relevant and cool and a place where you've got to look. And all of a sudden, there aren't the whole aesthetic isn't about a look. It's about looking like you haven't got a look at all. Do you know what I mean?
Looking like you always have.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like long, nothing hair. Yeah. Actually, I remember like 98, 99, I remember assisting Sam, like I think it was my first show, like assisting
you
him.
You assisted Sam that night on her first show?
Yeah, I went to see his Asian. I went to see all the Asians and they were like, oh, I think we can put you on the team with Sam. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, I used to stand at the back of, like the news agents at school, like picking up, do you remember that magazine Top Model? And they used to do like a, an issue over like one model each. It was like one.
Oh my God, Claudia, I would love
Claudia
that.
Schiffer issue, Linda issue. Anyway, I remember seeing these pictures of Sam in these magazines, you know, like in Elle, and being like, that was just like where I wanted to. So I got to assist him. I remember watching him, I think he was cutting Erin O'Connor's hair with a razor. And I was like, that's so cool. You know, it was like suddenly he was giving like girls like those like endy hair, you know, like it wasn't like, you know. And I think I went to a Sassoon course to learn how to cut hair, which was the complete opposite of that. You know, everything's very graphic and perfect, and I saw something completely different. I thought that was, you know. So, and then I remember going on another shoot with another hairdresser, and he had these big clumpy, these straightening irons. I'd never seen anything like them, and you know, just straighten hair. Like, this is way before GHD or any of that. And so I got hold of them, and he said, oh, straighten her hair out. So he used these things, and they were like amazing. Like nothing could get your hair.
They weighed a ton.
And they, do you remember, they were like these big black irons. They weren't ceramic, none of that existed. And they just straightened women's hair out, like poker straight, like Japanese hair. And so I came, I was like, I've got to find the manufacturer. And we started selling them. And, you know, and then there was like this whole straight hair thing. So to me, it's always been like, how do you make it cool? How do you make it relevant? And, you know, how do we give people hair that they really want? Because I think at the time, I probably started at a time where it was all just a bit bleh. I just found it all a bit, I mean, the salon side of it.
Yeah.
I found it all a bit.
But that meant anything was possible in a weird way. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it did. I think the salon side of things has changed massively in the past, I don't know, 10, 12 years, if not longer. I think it's a whole new generation of people, and I think that's really good.
I'm always a bit surprised when I go to the hairdresser, because it is a different experience from how it used to be.
Is it?
I think so, just as a punter.
Why, in what sense?
It's a two-way street. It's a conversation, and it's much quicker.
Yeah.
And it's not about, and I'm talking about like back in the day, I suppose, when I was a kid, I only went to the hairdressers a few times before I got into this industry. But that was about creating a particular look that you could never maintain.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like there's far more personalisation.
There's far more personalisation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think at the time Oh, I'm going to sound like I'm blowing my own trumpet here, but in fact, I'm not going to blow my own trumpet. I'm going to blow my dad's trumpet because it was his idea. But there was, when was it? About 2006, we had, there's a point to this story. I have to remember the point before I kind of whittle on. 2006, it was quite a tough time, like in the salon. Congestion charge just got brought in.
Oh, yeah.
And it basically wiped out, I don't know, 35% of our business, like overnight. Because people just didn't, like, why am I spending £8 to drive into town, like, I think £5 at the time, whatever it was. And, you know, through those times of, like, problems, it makes you think. It makes you, like, what can we do? And we were sat in this, like, PR meeting one day, and my dad came out with, why don't we do a blow-dry bar in Topshop? And everyone was like, yeah. And I went, yeah, and we could have menu, we could have like looks. And it was this weird like thing, right? And at the time, and this going back to the point of this before I whittle on, the point of this is that at the time I felt like, as you were saying, you used to go to the hairdresser and there was like, it wasn't very personalised, so everyone would get a blow dry. Do you know what I mean? In that like boofy, bad. And I was like, and then the salon at the time, so it goes back to like, we were trying to shake up like salons and make it cooler. I was like, well, there's not just a blow dry. There's a straight, there's a wavy, there's a curly, there's a big, there's a bit big, bit small. You know what I mean? There's all these.
Bouncy.
This is how it started. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, it shouldn't just be a blow dry. It should be like, it should be this range of looks. And I think, in a way, I think what we were trying to do was like make it more personal, like make it more individual, and like try and give all these guys like the expertise of how to do that. Because I think, you know, we started doing shows, we were kind of experimenting with different techniques and stuff, and I think that was when it started getting exciting. Was like, how can you, you know, let's give this to people.
That also puts some autonomy into the client's hands, though, because they can say really easily, because I remember those blow dry bars, and I also remember you had the updos as well. I think I might have had an updo for Fashion Week.
What, with your whinge?
No, not with my whinge. But I had like a really cute one that was all plaited down here.
Yeah.
There was a big plait here. Kat did it at the Harvey Nichols.
Okay.
Loved her. And it was, and I would never have gone in and asked for that, but because it was given to me as like a menu
option. Yeah, yeah.
I really enjoyed playing.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I mean, I think that's great. Like, I think, like, I don't know, from a fashion perspective, like, we're not in a... It's not like in the 90s, and when I started, it was like, everyone wanted the Jennifer haircut. You know, it was like the Jennifer Aniston was, like, the thing. And now, like, the idea of just one haircut for all just seems so weird and wrong, right? Like,
do you think it's because people understood that everyone's hair type was different? Because the fact is, Jennifer Aniston, and love the woman, don't get me wrong, but she's got very naturally curly hair that, when straightened, reads as thick.
Mm-hmm.
And her hair is obviously thick anyway, but it reads as like the perfect straight hair. But her hair is naturally curly. So if I went into a hairdresser and I said, I want Jennifer Aniston's hair from Friends, I couldn't have it. Because my hair's very fine and wispy, it's thin around the front, so it would just get static.
Yeah, but I think there was this desire for everyone to have the same thing then, no?
Yes, but I think a lot of people just walked around dissatisfied with their Jennifer.
Yeah, maybe.
Their Rachel.
Maybe.
Until somebody said, you know, actually, with your hair type, if we cut into it a bit, you'll still have a similar shape, but you'll get a bit of movement around the back and it won't be so...
I think it's more than that. I think hairdressing's changed. I think the way in which it's approached has changed. I mean, I'm going to sound... really arrogant, well, this isn't meant to be, but I think that hairdressing was taught the same way for a long time, you know.
Yeah.
It was taught by a certain disciplines, and I think for a long time people got hairdressers, they got quite lazy, because it was like, and I think that I'm not taking the credit for this at all, but I think like over the past 10 years, the idea of having menus, whether that's like the blow dry bars or whether that's just this idea of choice, it kind of made and I think this whole idea of open, and this is maybe one of the positives of like social and web and all the rest of it, is like it made so when I started you could only get information or know-how from being backstage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you can sit in a bedroom wherever you are and basically see how a look is created.
Yeah.
So I think that the whole idea of like know-how, and you know, we were doing kind of like, you know, messy waves 12 years ago, and when we started the blow dry bar, and that was like no one could do it because they didn't have the ability, they didn't know how, they didn't have the know-how. Now everyone has to do everything within 5 seconds because it's out there, it's public, it's which is a great thing as well. So it's given,
you have,
I don't
to
know,
have expanded your skill set essentially.
Well, you have to, because people are demanding that, they know it's possible. And I think that it's made hairdressers, it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of given, it's probably given hairdressers a bit of a kick to be like, well, I've got to be able to do this and I've got to be able to do that, and I can't just be this hairdresser that stands behind a chair and says, you're going to have this and do it, you know, like one specific way. I think it's so much more democratic now, isn't it? I mean, that's a good, that's an upside of like social and the web, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. It does, because if you see more, the more influences you get, obviously you're going to incorporate that into what you're doing.
But even in the sense of like, you know, people, like, I suppose customers being able to look at videos of like how things are done. So if customers can see that, then hairdressers have got to know how to do it. And I think for a long time, there were a lot of hairdressers that were like in salons that just didn't, they weren't kind of, I think it wasn't progressing, and I think it has massively.
They learned their skill, and then that.
And then that was it.
Was appropriate on that head in that chair at that time.
Yeah, and then I think, and now you have this whole new wave of like, an industry which is like totally not that. It's totally like, it's gone 360. It's like, you know, so much choice.
Do you feel people are more persuadable in the chair, and perhaps also come in with a clearer idea of what they want? Is the relationship between the hairdresser and the client different than it used to be?
I don't know really. I think we're in a time at the moment where everyone's obsessed with cutting their hair off. Like, that's like a confidence thing, and that's come from certain like celebrities that have done it, and so therefore if so and so does it, then I could do it. I think there's that, which is great. And we're definitely in this time where it's like all about haircuts, you know, and people are much more confident to be able to do it. I think there's less like horror associations, you know what I mean? Like, I think there used to be, when I started, there was a lot of like, women like be like very scared of cutting the hair off. So I think, I don't know, I think maybe people are more experimental because they...
Sorry, I'm chuckling because a few years ago my mother was going through treatment and my hair was really long. It was probably the longest it's ever been, like nape of my, small of my back. And it just felt really awful to have really long hair when she was losing hers.
Mm.
So I went to the hairdresser and I said, it was at the end of a press day, and I was like, is there any chance I can just get, I don't need it. I hate fuss. So if I can go to a hairdresser and just get the cut and walk out and just shake my hair, I'll do it, and then I'll style it at home. And I was like, I don't want to take up anyone's time, but I just need to have my hair cut off. We had this chat and I told this wonderful, wonderful girl about what was going on, and she said, okay, let's do this. It's going to be all right. And I was going for, you know, very short.
Oh, wow.
And we talked about it, and then she went to go and cut my hair and I just shot forward in the chair. And she said, do we need to have a bigger chat about this? I did it, but there's something really scary about it.
Yeah, massively. Massively. I mean, I think for most people it's like their security blanket. Mm. Like,
because I was thinking about this the other day, because I remember years and years and years ago it used to be this thing that women over 40 couldn't have long hair.
Yeah, it's like,
and as someone who's 40 this year, I was like, there ain't no way.
Yeah,
I am going to go for any crop.
It's turned on its head. It's like, who said that? Why is that true? It's not.
I must have read it in a magazine.
Don't you think like we're culturally been like, maybe growing up, like our mums or grandmas had shorter hair, so therefore we thought that's how it had to be, and then now you look at Julianne Moore and you're like, no, it doesn't make any sense. Like, there's, I don't know, maybe we're younger for longer as well. Like,
I think we're younger of mind and spirit than our parents' generation would have been. Definitely.
Yeah.
A lot of us are still sort of acting slightly teenage.
Yeah, me included.
You are also part of the House of Experts, which I would like to talk to you about. What does that mean?
About a year and a bit ago, I was invited to be part of a panel of experts, I suppose, for John Frieda.
Now, just to clarify something, because a lot of listeners might not necessarily know. Brands don't hate each other. If Daniel Hirschman and John Frieda were to see each other in the street, they wouldn't have a scrap, would they?
Oh, no.
Like, everything's quite friendly.
No, I've met, my dad's met John many times, and actually cycled to Paris with him for a charity a few years ago. Yeah, no, I mean, I've got enormous, huge respect for John. I mean, there were two brands growing up, like, I mean, I talked a bit about like the hairdressers that I thought, you know, were amazing. There were two brands growing up that I was in absolute awe of, and John Frieda was one of them.
Which was the other?
It was Bumble and Bumble, but and I used to use the analogy of kind of I saw us as somewhere in between the two. I mean, used to sign and say, like, you know, when I was in this mission of like, oh, gotta make sounds cool and all this, and I was like, well, you know, so basically there's there's John Frieda and there's Bumble, and Bumble was only in New York at the time, and it was
it was super fashion,
and it was like, and it wasn't really a product company at the time. It was just like, to me it was just like the height of cool. Like, it was like, if I can make us halfway or even a quarter of the way to what Bumble had done in New York at that time, I was like, then we've done it. I'd like, that was the mission, right? And then I kind of, but I also loved the kind of, I'd come from a background of salons that were kind of, you know, really special places, like nice places to go, and they felt, I don't want to use the word posh, but they felt quite chic, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, if you can marry those two, right? That would be just mecca.
Yeah.
But that was always, I always used to, so John Fried for me was just like, growing up, and so many things that John did, and like the history of it, so many of the collaborations he did when he was involved, when it was his business, I was just like, oh, that was amazing. Like, you know, he did all these collaborations with different hairdressers, like with, I think, Orlando and Serge and Sally Hirschberger, and opened salons with them and products with them, and I was just like, that's just so cool.
Mm.
And Julieta from TCS, who is TCS,
hold the line, caller.
Thank God it's Julieta from TCS, I had, she'd worked with John for years.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to, like, I was like, I just want to work with TCS. Like, for years. And then,
is that one of the reasons why you were so keen to work with TCS?
Well, it's like, it was so, like, I'd known Julieta, like, I think, for years.
She's very cool.
So brilliant, brilliant, and built the most amazing business. And Joe Jones and, you know, the whole team, we've been working for 3 years. But so that was, I always make this joke, no, Joe doesn't believe me, I was always wanted to work with you guys. always, you know, because I was like, you know, part of what John did was what Julieta and everyone did, you know, it was, so I don't know, so anyway, it's going back to your original thing about House of Rep. So I was invited to this panel, to be part of this panel last year, which John Frieda called the House of Experts, and I think that seemed to go really well. We did a talk, I think, as part of their press day. It was me and sat on this panel of me, and there was Kerry Wan, who was,
oh, I love Kerry so much,
just one of, like, as growing up, like, you know, looking at his pictures, like looking at his perfect finger waves, and, like, you know, that was like in awe of him. And there was Lee Keats, I think, who I don't know very well, but got to know on the day. And Sam McKnight, who's obviously, you know, enormous, like a great, you know, amazing.
Mega McKnight.
But I had to sit on his panel with, like, in between Sam and Kerry, being like, ooh, you know, scared. And it was amazing. Like, Kathleen Bear Murray did an interview, and with all of us, and it was really good, actually, and it went all right, and so much so that I think I expanded the kind of relationship with John Frieda, and now I've become their UK creative director, which has been really amazing. Has been an amazing, like, learning experience, and you know, to be working with a brand that I actually, you know, kind of grew up with, and had so much, like, massive admiration for, is, like, pretty mecca.
It is pretty good. And also, tell me about art and commerce. I think this might feed into your work ethic and being insanely creative.
So I suppose I don't feel like I ever really belong anywhere, because I kind of exist in, like, lots of different forms. I tend to kind of think, like, you know, I tend to worry about what I put on in the morning, because I kind of don't feel like, well, that's, I'm going to have a meeting with, you know, I don't know, our bank manager, or have I got, you know, something with John Fried, or am I on a photo shoot, or am I in the salon? It's all kind of, they're all really weird, they're all really different roles, right?
Just as a side note, you know, this is why Mark Zuckerberg wears exactly the same clothes every day.
Yeah, maybe I should start doing that.
Because he says,
I think you have to have the confidence to do that. No? I mean, I just don't know if I do. And sometimes I quite like wearing a suit.
I like the idea of it. I like the idea of having a morning ritual where everything is the same. Like, you make your bed, you brush your teeth the same way, you just put on the same clothes. And therefore your mind is already concentrating on the task at hand. And so you actually deal with that
There's a few people in fashion that do that.
I mean, Tom Ford has a ritual.
Yeah, and Pat McGrath wears the same clothes, and Jo McKenna, who's probably the best fashion stylist in the world, is religiously in a white shirt, a grey cashmere jumper, and a black pair of Levi's and a pair of New Balance, and it's like it's like the same, and he has like, you know, 10 of each, and just keeps buying the same things. And I'm like, that's pretty amazing, really.
I actually love it.
Yeah, he looks great.
But you're more of a creative chameleon.
Yeah, so I don't know, I've got these kind of lots of different job roles, really. And so how did I get to art and commerce? So one of my you know, big kind of pillars of like my work, I suppose, has always been about session work, making pictures and videos and fashion shows and all that stuff. And I started doing tests when I was like 17. So tests were like just to get pictures for your book, which weirdly now doesn't even exist because
no one has a
book. Just
no
have
one
an
has
Instagram
a portfolio
page.
Anymore.
I know. I've still got one at home. No one sees it.
I was talking to a hairstylist the other day, 25, and I was like, what do you keep a portfolio? And they were like, what's
a what?
That?
I know. Used to like polish it. Like, there was this shop in Covent Garden called Brodie's, I think it's called, and he used to go there, and they would make the book. So everyone had a book. You know, makeup artist, hairdresser, photographer, you all had a book, and there were these beautifully made leather bound books
and everything on beautiful quality like paper.
Yeah, it was like acetate papers that you like with sleeves, and you'd have to replace them, and then your agent would charge you £50 every month to replace them, because they had to be perfect. And they were like, yeah, they were like a souped up model portfolio.
Yeah. Models don't have portfolios.
Yeah, I know. They just bring an iPad.
Yeah.
If that. I don't know where I was. So I started testing like really early because I really wanted to, you know, work on that side of things. And to cut a long story short, I got an amazing break by a lady called Kim Sion, who at the time owned a agency called Smile. Who,
what a brilliant name, Kim Sion.
Yeah, she was like the powerhouse of like the agents. She represented every amazing photographer at the time. And she, I don't know how it happened, but she came in one day and cut her hair. I used to give her really bonkers haircuts, and then completely out of the blue, it was like round about, as I said, it was like a few weeks after September the 11th, because I remember going on the plane, she phoned me up and said, oh, are you free tomorrow, can you go to Sardinia? And I was like, yeah, sure. She's like, what's it for? She's like, oh, I can't tell you.
Did she not tell you because she thought you might
I just don't know, I don't know if it was certain or whatever. And then I think like a couple of hours later she said, okay, so it's this Masonian, it's with Giselle, and it's with Matt Marcus, and yeah, you'll be fine. Guido said, if you want to call him, you can. So I was, I think, 21 or 22, I don't know. And I mean, even the idea of phoning Guido was scary. But so I did that, and it, you know, she called me up at the end. She said, oh, when are you coming in? I want to sign you up. So she took me on. She was like my agent for about 2 years, and she really was like, I mean, people say like she, like that was my break, like that was like, she really, something happened, because I've been
sliding,
yeah, I mean, I'd doing kind of bits and pieces, I'd been doing like, you know, the Sunday papers, and I've been doing like a little bit for ID and this, that, and the other, and then suddenly there's something that just happens, and that happened, and that was amazing. She represented me for a couple of years, and then she closed the agency, she kind of retired from it all, went on to do other things, and I had another agent for 12 years, I think about 12 years, called Julian Watson, who just started, and it was an agency that was kind of co-owned between Julian and Guido, so I had to go for a little interview with Guido, for, you know, to get the green light about whether Julian could take you on. That was horrifically scary at the time, but amazing.
Yeah.
And I think at the time there was me, there was a girl called Samantha Hillaby, who was a great hairdresser, and they took Paul Hanlon on just after me. So it was really small, and it was amazing at the time. And then, I've been there 12 years, and then I think I'm kind of looking for a change, and I changed direction really, and art and commerce was, I don't know, it's always one of those places that you look at when you start, you know, they represent all the best photographers in the world, and you know, obviously Guido's there and other amazing hair and makeup artists, so they agreed, one, don't know why, to take me on. I think
take
I've
that
been there
compliment,
a couple of, well, yeah, I should take that compliment, I know. But they did. They took me on a couple of years ago, and it's been really amazing. It's been amazing, you know. A very different way of working with them, an American agency. So a very different like mindset, but it's.
You probably like that though, don't you?
Yeah,
you
it's
like
really
it's
kind of
different.
Got an amazing agent who's a super, super, super nice American guy. So it's all, you know.
Do you like wearing lots of different hats?
Yeah, I love it. I love the. I think I just get bored easily. I went to see this Chinese doctor the other day when I was away, and he said something like, "You." It was a really weird experience. Like he didn't
tell me because I saw one for the first time 2 months ago.
He didn't touch me. It was like he just did a lot of like his hands were kind of just floating above me. All I know is I felt amazing afterwards, but he managed to say a lot of stuff about me that was really like on point.
Did he look
point.
At your tongue?
No.
Huh. So not a traditional Chinese person.
No, he was like a Chinese healer.
Oh.
And he said you get really bored and you need lots of challenges, otherwise you panic. Because I panic a lot. Panic that everything's going wrong, it's all going to end tomorrow.
How do you deal with that though? Because I'm the same. Like I am an anxious character. My anxiety levels are always close to the flood wall. But in the last 2 years, they have properly flooded. And I've experienced anxiety properly for the first time. And I didn't know what it was. I honestly didn't know what it was. For about 18 months, I just thought I thought I was dying. Thought something really terrible was happening to me.
Yeah, it's horrific. It's the most crippling. It's really the most crippling thing, I think.
Mm.
I mean, how did you get over it?
I went home and stood on my parents' doorstep and cried and said I'm exhausted. And I went to bed in my old childhood bedroom
and rested
for 3 days. I didn't get out of bed for 3 days. It was just physical exhaustion, mental exhaustion, yeah. It was just, and it had just been building up and building up, and I was just literally going from one episode of being highly, highly stressed to the next, and was in a cycle,
yeah.
And just didn't really know what it was. So it was only when I was able to go home and say, I think I need to sleep.
It's weird, because like while we're in that, we don't join the dots up and go, actually, I need to like have a rest, or I need to have a break, or... actually that's what we need to do, but just kind of ignore it.
Yeah.
I mean, I do.
Even a really good friend of mine, my friend Marcia, phoned me up the other day and she said, I worry about you because every time I call you, you're working. You never take a weekend off. You're always working. And so she's like, I'm going to be texting you, telling you to book a holiday and stuff like that. And I think when you are tend to be creative and you've got hunger and passion, you can forget to look after yourself.
Massively. I mean, I don't know, I think probably you probably judge yourself more than, well, I know I do, I judge myself more than probably anyone else judges me.
Oh, harshest critic.
Mm. And that makes it worse.
When I first published this, I was telling Luke before we hit record, because Luke has been very generous with his praise for the fact that he's been enjoying the show. And honestly, when I first published it, it's the first thing I've done on my own. Everything else I've ever published or put out there has been behind, with a brand, a big magazine or what have you. This was just me. This is me going, hey, I think you should listen to this. And I felt arrogant and I felt ridiculous. I uploaded it to iTunes. I turned everything off. I went into my room, lights off. Didn't even get on the bed. I just hid on the other side of the bed. And I was like, no one can find me here.
It's scary though, isn't it? It's like, I don't know about you, but I probably ignored social media for a bit too long. Like, I was like, I wish it would just go away.
It'll never catch on.
Oh, it'll never catch on. I think I was kind of right about Twitter a bit. I was like, oh, it's not, you know, because I think it's all changed, hasn't it? Like, Everyone's
yes.
Instagramming. Everyone
yeah.
was tweeting. Like, but anyway, whatever. I think like it's all about finding how it works for you, right?
It's
using awesome. It like so it feels okay for you. Like that's. That's
are
where
you talking
I've got
about
to.
In terms of anxiety?
Yeah,
I think social
well,
media is
anxiety
bad for that.
And like the fact that it ain't going anywhere. It's here to stay, whether we like it or not. And so, how do you have it as part of you and get comfortable with it? Because I battled with it a long time. I didn't want to do any of it. I was like, we're not going on Instagram. We're not on Facebook. Da, 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 da. And then you have enough people, especially as a brand, that come into you and say, no, you have to do this.
Mm.
That sooner or later you realise that as a brand you have to have it, and it's how you treat that. But as a person, you know, I was never on anything, and then a year ago I started Instagram. Now I really enjoy it, I'm proud of it, but because I felt like I've done it like with integrity and how I want to do it, whereas
on your terms.
Yeah, on my terms. And I think you look at a lot of people and it's very easy to kind of judge a lot of Instagram. Oh, it's, you know, people want to be famous and it's this 5 minutes of fame and da-da-da. You know what I mean? You slag it off and so you're like, well, I don't want to be like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so if you can get comfortable with doing it your way and doing it a way that you feel is good for you and reflective of you and isn't too kind of egotistical. I mean, that was my whole thing. I don't want to look like I love myself. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, so did the ego thing make you feel panicky and make you feel...
It was probably a bit like you. Like, you load up the podcast and then you hid. Right,
yeah.
And I'm like, why? I mean, I'm gonna
completely
put a,
normal
I'm
behavior.
Gonna put a selfie up, and everyone's gonna laugh, and but then I need to do this, or I don't need to do that, and it's you just don't know because it's all new, isn't it? So you
yeah.
don't know how to do it. You don't know how to do it and make it all right. And
yeah.
I think if you can just get, so I got to, it's taking me a while. I got to point out, no, actually, I quite like it now. Actually, I look at it, oh, it kind of looks all right, maybe. Do you know what I mean? Like,
but tell me, because I do, because obviously having sort of dealt with it myself. How do you cope with your anxiety? Because I had the same thing, but I would go on shoots. I was on a shoot once.
A lot of therapy.
Panic. Really?
Yeah.
See, I think therapy is massively underrated. In this country, I think it's got still got a taboo.
I mean, I haven't beaten it, so I don't have the answer, but...
are you able to identify it before
yeah,
it turns into something that you can't manage?
I think I first knew what anxiety was when I was about, I don't know, 17? And to me it was always like a weird funny feeling in my stomach, and I hated the feeling, but it was like it just constantly felt like I was nervous for an exam.
Yes.
Like, and I was like, what is that? I hate, and I just hated it. And it would come up, I would never really be able to make the link between what it was, why it was happening, so that was even weirder. And it would come and go for years, and I think looking back on it, it probably spiked when I was very stressed or very nervous about a work thing or like, you know, trying to get out of a bad relationship or like whatever that was. And then I don't know, I did quite a few years of like psychoanalysis, which like maybe was good or maybe it was good. I think it was good, but at some point I had to stop, and I did stop. And that was.
It sounds like. Do you internalise your anxiety? So, for people to say you seem really calm, were you carrying quite a lot of?
Yeah, I don't think people look at me and think, "Oh, he's really." I'm not outwardly like.
Yeah.
I'm not outwardly like shaking.
But you're feeling
like,
it on the inside.
Yeah,
yeah.
I would feel it. And I remember I had a therapist once who said, "It's never going to go away." Right.
Here's
I was like, well, what's the point of me even being here? Like, do you know what I mean? She said, no, well, you're just going to be able to manage it better. So I was like, well, that's the same as it going away, isn't it?
Mm.
I was like, oh, that used to really annoy me.
Yeah.
So I suppose I've always kind of had it, and maybe I've just got a bit better at dealing with it. And I was a complete workaholic, and I've learned to have a bit more balance, which I think probably helps. By the way, I'm not talking like I'm totally cured. I still have.
I don't
fair,
think anyone
I,
is.
I still have like quite bad bouts of it. I think over the past couple of years, it developed more into kind of health anxiety, and so it's something you live with and you try and manage it and drive everyone else mad that's around you.
See, so Pixie Wu, who we obviously all love, Sam and Nick did a video about Sam's anxiety, and it was on social media, so obviously there's going to be positive comments, and obviously there's going to be people who are like, meh, meh, meh. And someone put something quite dismissive of, oh, everyone's talking about anxiety these days. And yes, they are. And it's not because everyone suddenly jumped on a bandwagon. It's because I think people actually understood what it feels like, that it has a name.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, because for years I didn't know what the label was.
Mm. People would always say to me, oh, you're stressed. Are you stressed about the little things?
I think it's funny because the stress causes the anxiety, which then makes the stress feel even worse. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, maybe it's just people used to say they were stressed and now they understand the results of the stress. Because the results of stress is anxiety.
And anxiety is something you can work on. So actually saying, I'm having issues with anxiety, is a really positive thing. Because as soon as you have a name, you can begin to take steps to help yourself.
Yeah, I was listening to, I don't know if it was Marissa Peer or someone else, was saying there was this whole, oh God, I've got to look it up, of who it was. But it was about making stress your friend. So if you view stress as you tell yourself that actually it's just a challenge that you're just going to overcome this particular thing that you have to do today. If you make friends with it, it becomes it doesn't look like stress, and actually your body reacts kindly to it. It's like the fear that you associate with the stress that's the damaging part, whereas
it's
all
like
about
Marissa Peer's arm thing.
I don't, it wasn't Marissa Peer, it was someone else. I'll have to look it up. It was about how you have to make it friendly.
Yeah, Marissa Peer said a version of this which I employed and it really worked. So I injured myself in the gym last year. I was also hammering myself in the weights room because I was like, if I can turn myself into a fat burning machine, I'll just be so much happier with my life generally. But considering I was already stressed, I just put too much stress on my body. And so I just walk for an hour every day.
And it's
an hour and it's fresh air. And the first few weeks I go out and I'm like, this is pathetic. I should be running. I should be doing something else. Listen to her and I would get a go out and I say, it's really good that you're going out for an hour's walk, Emma. Think about how fresh the air's going to be. And it's amazing how it does change your mind. You just completely change that dialogue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they say walking's like the best thing you can do, right?
Mm.
I mean, I need to do more of it. I need to do more of a lot of things.
I need to do walking, actually, because I live slightly outside of London. It's great, but walking in London, I'm just a stomper with a very angry look on my face, which isn't proper walking, I don't think.
Like most people. I mean, everyone's walking with their face down. I saw an Instagram post the other day about someone in New York that had, there was like a pattern on the, there was like a sign on the floor saying, look up, get off your phone.
I like that.
I thought that was really good.
I have to find something similar. Now, to end, because my time with you has drawn to a close, what other innovations are coming other than the whinge?
I don't know.
Clipping unicorn fringe?
No, I think we did all the kind of hair pieces at a time when I think that, you know, when everyone...
loads.
Yeah, because I think at the time, I think we launched it, I don't know, 2000, just fairly shortly after we did the blow dry bars, because basically everyone had long hair and wanted like a million different ways to wear long hair. So I was always using pieces on shoots, and you know, you still do carry like so much with us.
Mm.
I was like, well, we have to make that available to people, make it easy. So I don't know, it was a time, I think it was a time that I felt that was relevant. And for us, it's always about like adapting. You know, if we're going to bring something to the market, it's got to be a real reason.
Mm.
Like, we've never done shampoos and conditioners. Like, we've never, and have never had a reason to or want to, because there's a lot of people doing it really, really well. So
yeah,
if we're gonna bring something, it's got a real reason for being, and it's got to stand on its own two legs.
Mm.
So for us, it's like, well, there's loads of things we're like working on developing, and you know, constant. But I like to think we do it all right because there's a real reason to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. More goals to come.
Lots more. Yeah.
Whilst measuring everything out with the lovely balance of,
well, like, yeah,
thinking, not doing anything.
That's one of the goals,
it,
isn't it? Try and get a bit more balance.
Yeah. Yes. Well, on that note, let's find some balance in the rest of our afternoon. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
You've been such
amazing.
A pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime.
Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to get in touch with the show, don't forget you can email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. Or why not follow me on Twitter? I'm at Emma Guns, and I'm also at Emma Guns over on Instagram, where my Insta stories sometimes give you a little bit of a sneak peek of who I am recording podcasts with for upcoming shows. Thanks again, and see you next time.